This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The rankings of Michigan schools were all over the map this year, but still relied on to determine the worst schools.
You know, if a school is in the 7th or 8th or 9th percentile this year and you close the bottom five, you're going to get a new list of bottom five next year, and it becomes a little bit of a, you know, revolving door.
We've got some Michigan history for you, such as why the state capital was moved from Detroit to Lansing.
One of the things that Lansing offered was free land and free buildings.
And we talked to the leaders of two very different cities about the state continuing to take a larger bite of the state sales tax that it shares with municipalities.
From 2003 to 2014, we lost about $13.3 million. And, you know, that's almost the equivalent of a full year's general fund budget for us.
Plus, we'll talk about the effects of climate change on Michigan forests, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On the show today, we'll discuss Lansing's decision to cut revenue sharing to Michigan communities and how those cuts affect services and the quality of life.
You know, to have a rainy day fund at that magnitude that's being proposed and being talked about in combination with also reducing the income tax levy, I think that that could potentially be a combination or a mixture for ultimate financial disaster and ruin for many more communities across this state.
But first, what's up is down, what's down is up when it comes to ranking schools in Michigan. Dozens of schools found they dropped 50 points in the rankings, while others soared from near bottom to near top in the rankings. To help us understand what's going on, Erin Einhorn joins us via Skype. She's a reporter with Chalkbeat, which focuses on education issues. Let's start with some examples of schools that dropped in the state rankings.
Well, some of the big ones in Detroit include the most prestigious, most selective schools in the city, including Cass Tech and Renaissance and Bates Academy and one of the University Prep Charter School, High School. We're all among schools. There were 31 schools in the state of Michigan that dropped by more than 50 points between the last school ranking in 2014 and the most recent one in 2016.
Wow. Okay, so who decides these rankings?
The rankings are put out by the Michigan Department of Education, which has been using test scores and graduation rates to make a big ranking of every school in the state every year since, I think, 2011.
So what's caused this dramatic change in the school rankings? I mean, it seems like they'd be fairly consistent.
Well, they've changed both the tests that the scores are drawn from to calculate the rankings, and they've changed the formula used for the ranking calculation.
That's right, because we went from MEEP to MSTEP. So tell me about the changes in the formula. What does that do?
Well, we went from MEEP to MSTEP, and we also went from the ACT to the SAT in high school. And some schools adapt to the change better than others, so that could account for why some schools would go up and some schools would go down. And then they also changed the formula. So historically, the Department of Ed has included something called an achievement gap, which in 2014 accounted for 25% of a school's ranking. And the achievement gap in this circumstance refers to the difference between the high performers in a school and the low performers in a school.
Why would they drop that?
Well, I think the criticism of it is that it masked some challenges in schools. So if every child in a school is performing badly, the school will have a low achievement gap, whereas a school that has, you know, many high performers and then many low performers would have a high achievement gap. And so some of the schools, some of the more, you know, affluent or higher performing schools were finding that the achievement gap calculation was hurting their score, whereas, you know, there were concerns that there were schools that were seriously challenged and were low performing that could use some extra attention that were having artificially inflated scores.
So how long have they used this achievement gap in calculating the formula?
Since the start of the top to bottom ranking, which I believe was 2011.
It took them this long to figure out that that might not be a good measure.
Well, they want to update it, you know, every now and again. So they, you know, every couple of years, they want to take a look and say, are we measuring schools appropriately? Are we getting the right kind of information? What they didn't expect is that, I mean, so the Department of Ed knew that they were changing a bunch of things. And so in order to protect schools from serious consequences from that. The Michigan Department of Ed said they were putting, you know, what they call, you know, like an accountability pause and telling schools, don't worry, you know, we're changing the test, we're changing the formula, but we're not going to have any serious consequences for schools such as closure for a couple of years.
That's what the Board of Ed said, but the School Reform Office, which Governor Snyder took out of the Board of Education and put it under his authority, they used the rankings to say those 38 schools that they've been talking about in danger of closing. So if these rankings are so different and so wildly different, how could you base any decision on this?
There's definitely a lot of people asking that question. Part of it is actually in the law. So at least as it relates to the city of Detroit. So when the Detroit Public Schools legislation passed last summer that put $617 million into the Detroit school system to kind of save it from bankruptcy, there were a bunch of, you know, rules and restrictions put into that law. And one of them was that every school in the city of Detroit that was on the bottom 5% of the state ranking for 3 years in a row, you know, will be shut down. That's what the law says. And so the School Reform Office was, you know, complying with the law as they saw it and as the state attorney general saw it and saying, you know, not only should we do this, we have to do it. And so they made a list. Actually, the Department of Ed didn't put out the ranking list in 2015 because of their, you know, accountability pause. But the School Reform Office put out a list of just the bottom 5%. So then they used the rankings from 2014, this bottom five list from 2015, and the 2016 list to say, okay, this is 3 years of data, and these are the schools, these 38 schools, that are going to be closed or could be closed.
Now, we should say the state is giving those worst performing schools 60 days to come up with a turnaround plan. Do we have any idea what happens then?
I think for the most part, you know, most people believe that these schools are all going to stay open at least for a little while, they'll get an 18-month reprieve. But what happens in 18 months, you know, if the schools aren't able to meet their targets isn't clear. And then there's also the question, there were a whole host of schools that were put on notice that if they don't get off that bottom five list in 2017, the test that's being taken this spring, that they are in danger of being closed as well.
Okay. Your report didn't cover what I'm about to ask you, and that is, if you keep closing the bottom 5% of the schools every year, you're going to run out of schools before too long. I mean, why has the state taken this approach rather than finding out what's wrong with these schools and investing in them and trying to help these students out?
Well, that's certainly one of the criticisms of using the bottom 5% as a criteria for school closure, because, you know, if a school is in the 7th or 8th or 9th percentile this year and you close the bottom 5, you're going to get a new list of bottom 5 next year, and it becomes a little bit of a, you know, revolving door.
Or circling the drain, one of the two.
Something like that. But I should also note that the changes in the ranking system, obviously, the schools at the bottom, these 38 schools, are facing the most serious consequence, which is school closure. But higher performing schools are also facing very significant consequences as well, because this is a state where, you know, school districts are extremely competitive, you know, especially in cities like Detroit, where there's lots and lots of charter schools and kids can use schools of choice and can cross over to the other district. So if a school loses goes from a high ranking to a low ranking, you know, parents are going to vote with their feet and go to another school. So even for the schools that aren't being shut down, there's a real cost to them from having, you know, changes to the ranking system.
The title of your article is How Changes to Michigan's School Ranking System Hurt Cass Tech and Help the DeVos Family Charter School. Tell me about the DeVos Family Charter School.
The West Michigan Aviation Academy went from the 32nd percentile to the 87th percentile, which means it went up by 55 points in the same 2-year period.
So the Detroit public schools, a lot of them, went down by 50 points and the DeVos Charter School went up by 50 points.
There were schools across the state of different levels. It wasn't just that urban schools went down and, you know, I mean, the DeVos schools in Grand Rapids, it's also urban.
Okay. All right. So it was a mix then.
I mean, if there are patterns, I didn't identify them. I think somebody probably could. You know, a larger analysis might be able to determine, you know, what caused some schools to go up and other schools to go down. But there were so many things that changed.
Right.
So it is a known fact that when a test changes, more affluent schools are often better able to adapt to the change than lower income schools. So even if they hadn't changed the ranking system, you know, there's a strong likelihood that urban schools would have taken a bigger hit than suburban schools.
Because of the changes in the test, the MEEP to MSTEP and ACT to SAT, right?
Correct.
That is Erin Einhorn. She's a reporter with Chalkbeat. That article title again is How Changes to Michigan's School Ranking System Hurt Cass Tech and Help the DeVos Family Charter School. Thanks for telling us about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There is so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we cannot possibly know about all of it. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. That's why Stateside is teaming up with MI Curious, Michigan Radio's project that asks you to ask questions about our state and its people. On Saturday, April 22nd, we're going to do a Stateside in Flint at the Flint Institute of Arts. So help us produce the show. What questions do you have about Flint, its neighborhoods, or its people? We're especially interested in hearing from people who live in Flint right now. What questions do you have about your city? What does the media miss or misunderstand when covering Flint? Send us your questions by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's Wednesday. Time again to talk about our state's history, and Stateside's Cynthia Canty has you covered.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
So the 1835 Michigan Constitution says this: the seat of government for this state shall be at Detroit, or at such other place or places as may be prescribed by law until the year 1847, when it shall be permanently located by the legislature. Well, that raises the question, how did Lansing become the capital of Michigan? That happened 170 years ago this month. With us to answer that question, we welcome our partner from the Michigan History Center, Rachel Clark. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
And we want to welcome the Michigan State Capitol historian, Valerie Marvin. Hello, Valerie.
How are you?
You know, going right back to the very beginning, Valerie, why was Detroit chosen as Michigan's very first capital?
Well, Detroit had actually been our territorial capital. 1805 is when the Michigan Territory is created. Detroit's the capital at that point. It was the largest city, certainly, and it was also accessible by water, which was very important in an era when roads are, at best, terrible in most places.
That's got to be the understatement. So most people were kind of gathered right there because it was so accessible.
Yes. And Detroit had a very long history that, of course, goes back to the French period and had always been a place where people had gathered. So it made sense.
Rachel, when I think of just the sheer cost, one might wonder, why would any state move its capital? What was the reasoning here?
The initial reason was Detroit was right on the edge of the state, and no other state had their capital on the edge. Most of them were closer to the center. Plus, Detroit was right across the river from Canada, which in 1835, the War of 1812 was in living memory. And so it was decided when they wrote the Constitution that the capital simply couldn't stay in Detroit, that eventually it should be moved closer to the center of the state.
When you think about it, were there other areas in Michigan under consideration? I mean, look at a map. Mount Pleasant certainly looks to be more of a geographical center than Lansing.
There were quite a few, actually. Initially, they were using the Central Rail Line as their line of options. So towns like Ann Arbor and Jackson and Marshall were some of the early candidates for the new capital. And a gentleman named Enos Goodrich, who was from Tuscola County, he said that as the population moves and increases, you can't use the Central Rail Line as the boundary. You have to go north of that. And so towns like DeWitt and Lansing, and even Copper Harbor at one point, threw their names in as possible locations for the new capital.
So this selection of Lansing, it kind of had to be a compromise, didn't it?
It did. One of the things that Lansing offered was free land and free buildings. The state had gone through some economic problems in the late 1830s and 1840s, and so the choice of building a capital had to come with a very low, if zero, price tag. And so Lansing came in with free land and very, very cheap, if not free, buildings.
Bottom line, always matters. Valerie Marvin, was Lansing even a town at that point?
It was not. There was actually Lansing Township. When the town of Lansing was officially founded, that actually happened in the 1850s, 1859. And the settlement of Lansing, if you will, because it wasn't an official city, actually didn't start off as Lansing. It was originally called Michigan, Michigan, which for some reason did not catch on. And so they actually took the name from the name of the township and started to call it Lansing. But this was also debated in the legislature. In early 1848, they're throwing out all of these names for what this new place is going to be called.
When you stop and think about, here's our capital, Michigan, Michigan. What did the locals do to prepare for welcoming and becoming the state capital?
Well, there weren't a lot of locals in what became Lansing. There were certainly people in the area, and they were very excited. There's a great story from Delhi Township, actually, where a group of people heard that the capital was going to be in Lansing. So they cut down their biggest tree, they hauled it into Lansing, they gave it to the sawyer at the mill, and then everybody had three cheers for the fact that the capital had come. So everybody knew that when the capital came, power, money, investment, railroads, all of that was going to come with it. So it really was a huge boost to what was otherwise a collection of very small rural farming settlements. The key was they had to keep it because nobody was quite sure if they were going to stay in Lansing. So they really had to put their best foot forward. And people opened up their homes to accommodate legislators and staff the first session because Lansing didn't even have enough boarding houses and hotels to accommodate everyone.
What did moving the capital actually entail, Valerie? I mean, government in the mid-1800s had been a lot smaller than what we have today.
Absolutely, but government still had things. There were papers, there were books, there was furniture. They actually hired people to bring things up, and we know that not everything went terribly well because there was a claim made with the State Board of Auditors by a gentleman named John Keene, who said that he lost a horse in the process. His horse actually expired because of the efforts. And so he wanted the state to give him $75 to replace his horse. And he was actually successful with his claim. They allowed it.
Was there some controversy involving moving library records?
Well, the library books certainly would have been one of the more problematic things to move. The state library was very small compared to what it is today. I mean, we're talking books in one room. But again, it was this effort of bringing everything in. It was tough. Remember, there's no railroad that comes to Lansing. You have plank roads that are being built, certainly, but it's a very tough slog from Detroit.
What was the first Capitol building in Lansing like, Valerie?
It was small and it was very plain. It was a two-story wooden structure. It's about 100 by 60 feet, and it was built to be temporary. That's an important thing to remember. When they came to Lansing, they picked a site for the Capitol we're going to build today and the Capitol we're going to build someday when we have more money and can really make a permanent investment. So this building was always meant to be temporary. It filled up very quickly. By 1854, actually, they have to build a second office building for the state. And with that building, at least, they make sure it's brick. This first one was wooden, which is a huge problem when you talk about the fact that this is where all of the state's records are being kept. And you're living in an era when everything is lit and heated by fire.
don't even think about what that could mean. When did we get the Capitol building that we know today?
The current Capitol was actually dedicated on January 1st of 1879. It was a six-year construction project, so we broke ground in 1872. And everyone in Lansing breathed a huge sigh of relief the second construction began, because they knew that once the state made this investment, they were not going to pick up and move. And it was an investment. It cost almost $1.5 million. But you have to remember, in the 1870s, Michigan is growing. The state is doing very well, and we want to celebrate what we've accomplished. Our capital, in many ways, can be seen as sort of a coming-of-age moment, if you will. And people from all around the state came in to celebrate not only laying the cornerstone, but the dedication of the building itself. It was a proud moment.
Rachel Clark, this is really a reminder, isn't it, that the course of history can just turn on a dime, because we could have easily been talking about the state capital in DeWitt.
Absolutely. There are towns all over mid-Michigan that threw their hat in the ring, and Lansing was the one that was most centrally located and won the bid.
Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center and Michigan State Capitol historian Valerie Marvin sharing with us the story behind Michigan's capital. It was 170 years ago this month that state lawmakers decided to make the big move from Detroit to Lansing. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. The changing climate the Earth is experiencing is changing the forests in Michigan. Warmer and shorter winters affect trees and the pests and diseases that damage trees. Stephen Handler is a climate change specialist with the U.S. Forest Service. He's based in Houghton in the Upper Peninsula. What kind of changes are you seeing?
When I talk to people about climate change, the two big headlines that we have already observed in Michigan and really across the Midwest are, number one, our winters are becoming milder and more variable. And number two, more of our precipitation is being delivered in these big, heavy rainstorms that come all at once.
So if the winters are warmer and somewhat shorter, more pests are able to winter over. We see that in crops. What does it mean for trees?
So what milder winters mean for trees in terms of pests are that sometimes there are these lethal cold temperatures in our characteristic northern winters that have really kept the lid on a lot of pests and diseases that haven't been able to kind of infiltrate our area. One pest that is a good example of this is the hemlock woolly adelgid. Like its name suggests, it really attacks hemlock trees, kind of conifer that are iconic in northern forests. And when you get really cold weather outbreaks in the wintertime, negative 30, negative 40 Fahrenheit, that kills or puts a damper on the populations of these hemlock woolly adelgid. That's actually how the risk maps for this pest are drawn across the state, is based on how frequent do we get those really cold snaps in the winter. And as we've seen over the past couple of decades, we're getting those really cold outbreaks less and less reliably, which is allowing that pest in particular to spread northward.
Are there other impacts from warmer temperatures and less snow cover for trees?
Well, there's an interesting one that I didn't really realize until I started working in this part of the world, and it has to do more with the day-to-day business of managing forests and our woods. And that is, in many forests in Michigan, we depend on frozen ground or a minimum depth of snowpack, say 10 inches or more of snowpack, in order to actually get in there and manage the woods, in order to do harvests or other kinds of treatments.
So you're talking about managed logging in the wintertime.
Right. And so if we don't have frozen ground or a minimum snowpack, a lot of our forest area is actually off limits to forest management, because if you get in there with heavy logging equipment running around in the woods, you can do a lot of damage to soils. You can cause erosion, compaction and rutting, things that have cascading impact. So there are good reasons for this. We have rules and restrictions for low areas that are continually wet, or sensitive soils like clay soils that really could be compacted. So as we get milder winters and a shorter duration of winters, that really compresses our window of time where we can get in and do the necessary work in our woods.
Let me ask you, because, you know, a lot of people don't understand managed logging. In fact, any kind of logging sounds like it would be bad for the forests. Why would the U.S. Forest Service encourage logging?
Wow. This is a big question. There are several reasons, I guess. I'll give you an easy example. Many, many acres of forest land that exist in Michigan now are plantations, right? We have either planted species like red pine or white spruce in an area, and oftentimes those plantations are started with seedlings at very high densities in order to get them established. And periodically through time, every 15 or 20 years, it's necessary to enter those stands and thin those trees so that they have room to grow and they can stay vigorous and healthy and they're not overcrowded and stressed.
Got it.
Right? So that needs to happen periodically in order to keep that plantation on track and avoiding all sorts of problems.
Let me turn to another thing. Not only is the climate warming, but CO2 levels are rising. There's a cause and effect there. I've talked to scientists who are running these long experiments where they're artificially pumping carbon dioxide to trees. What are the effects of higher CO2 levels in a forest?
This is an active area of research, and really the impacts of this, we're just kind of beginning to figure out how many cascading impacts there are. I'll start with the simplest one, that trees grow by absorbing CO2 passively from the atmosphere. P peeling off carbon atoms and storing them as wood, as biomass, and then releasing oxygen. So when we grow trees in an atmosphere that is enriched in CO2, that's like growing them in a, you know, an all-you-can-eat buffet, right? They have more available carbon, and so trees respond to that. They grow faster. They put on more biomass each year, and some of the results we've seen from long-term growth trials in elevated CO2 environments demonstrate this. You're looking at 20-25% increased biomass in a forest that's grown with elevated CO2 compared to a control forest that's grown without elevated CO2.
So what we're seeing here because of climate change and because of an increase in CO2 is a mixed bag. Some things are really bad for trees. Some things are really good for trees. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the fact is that some tree species are able to take advantage of this extra CO2 and grow faster. There's some limits and there's some gray areas to this, right? CO2 is not the only thing that controls tree growth, so you have to have water and nutrients also to support that. So eventually there's a limiting point where more CO2 doesn't necessarily benefit tree growth. So there's a limit to which this effect will help trees. There's also some interesting research that's just come out in the last couple of years, which also suggests that forest pests, so bugs that eat leaves of trees, might actually increase the rate that they're consuming leaves to compensate for that extra growth. So something is triggering insects to eat more of these tree leaves when they're grown in elevated CO2 environments. We don't know yet why. So there may be some compounding factors here at work.
Let me ask you, what are some of the broader effects? How does it affect the lives of people who are not really connected in a direct way to Michigan forests?
That's a great question. I tell people that in many cases, the most important product we get from forests is not wood, it's water, right? I think that's something we can all relate to, is that we need clean and reliable supplies of water for drinking, for recreation, for agriculture, and for other ecosystems. Trees are actually our best filtration device that Mother Nature ever invented. Forests are a great way to reliably and consistently capture water, filter it into the soil, and then release it gradually and slowly through our groundwater into our lakes, rivers, and wetlands. So having healthy trees on the landscape ensures that we have healthy drinking water.
I've got one more question that I think I have to ask you, and that is, the proposed budget released by President Trump cuts a lot of programs and agencies. It also has ordered some agencies not to pursue study of climate change. Where does that leave you as a climate specialist and the U.S. Forest Service?
The Forest Service has actually been pretty clear on this, that recognizing the impacts of climate change and doing what we can to respond and prepare to climate change, that's just a fact of life now. That is what we need to do in order to be responsible stewards of the land and responsible land managers. So the Forest Service is taking this issue seriously, and it's still our priority. My work is still going to continue, regardless of what, you know, the arguments and public displays in Washington might be.
That's Stephen Handler. He's a climate change specialist with the U.S. Forest Service. He's based in Houghton, Michigan. Thanks for explaining all this to us, and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Your town is getting by on less money because for years, the state legislature has been taking a bigger share of the state sales tax. That's meant cuts in fixing streets and sidewalks, cuts in police and fire departments, and cuts in other city services. Why did the state government start taking a larger share? Well, because it needed to fix its own budget problems. Doing that forced municipalities into their own budget problems. Joining me to talk about that are city officials from two cities in different parts of the state. Marcus Pecha is city manager of Cadillac, a city of 10,000, about 50 miles south of Traverse City. And Karen Majewski, the mayor of Hamtramck, a city of about 20,000 in Metro Detroit. The Michigan Municipal League says from 2001 to 2014, municipalities lost out on about $6 billion because of reductions in revenue sharing. Marcus Pecha, how much has Cadillac lost during that period?
We have lost over $4.5 million during that period of time.
What's your annual budget?
Our annual budget in its entirety, including all funds, is about $19.5 million. Our general fund budget, or that money coming just from the taxpayers, is right around $6.5 million. So as you can see, that loss for Cadillac is really significant.
Mayor Majewski, how much money did Hamtramck lose from 2001 to 2014?
From 2003 to 2014, we lost about $13.3 million. And, you know, that's almost the equivalent of a full year's general fund budget for us.
For both of you, what kind of cuts have you made in city services? Mr. Petcha, we'll start with you.
Most notably, the city has cut staff. It's been a protracted process over the years. We're down about 20% from our high. We've essentially reduced our numbers of bodies to maintain, simply put, just our core set of public programs. And we're doing it with a skeleton crew. We've restructured our benefit program as well. So it's not just the removal of staff and keeping things the same, but it's been taking a whole new look at how we provide compensation as well to our staff, which has also been kept very much in check. We've had a very conservative approach to our benefit and compensation packages.
I think the legislature would say, well, good, they're being efficient. Have your citizens noticed a difference in city services?
I think so. To a certain degree, it almost depends on the season and the Mother Nature activities. You know, we're down to essentially one operational crew from our Public Works Department year-round. And so, especially in the winter, with winter conditions, it makes it more difficult for us to provide the same level of services that we want to provide and what our citizens expect. It takes, depending upon the conditions, anywhere from 2 to 5 days to completely clean up the town and remove the snow piles and relocate them, which is something that we used to be able to do in a faster fashion. So we're still getting the job done, but we're just having to do it differently. And also, certainly, our capital improvements projects, they have not stopped, but they certainly have slowed down. We're not able to do as many road improvements or other infrastructure-related improvements that we once used to be able to do. That's something that while people may not visually see, certainly we recognize that it's a problem. In the city of Cadillac, it could take anywhere from 70 to 85 years before a street is redone once it's done. That's certainly far beyond the life expectancy of a road. Exactly.
Mayor Majewski, same question. What kind of cuts have you had to make?
You know, I think that all cities in Michigan have been facing the same problem and addressing it in many of the same ways. You know, you look at what city services can be scaled back. You look at what you can do with personnel, how many jobs you can cut, how many positions you can combine. These are the things that we've been doing, what other sources of income there might be, and that's often grants, which, of course, are under the gun as well. So what adjustments you can make to union contracts and particularly OPEB benefits to our retirees.
Right.
That's always a target and an unpopular target and a regrettable target. You know, just as the state reneges on the promises that they've made to us in terms of funding, that means that we have to turn on our own former employees and pass a burden on to them that is also in many ways not fair. You know, I think that all cities are facing the problems and facing them in some of the same ways, looking to combine services with other municipalities. But many of those things were already done even before the downturn in the economy, the Great Recession, which affected all of us across the board, and the attempts by the state to also withhold funding from us. I mean, those are all things that any responsible city is looking to do anyway, looking for the ways to provide essential services and even more than essential services, the services that make a community a good place to live and provide a good quality of life. You're always looking for ways, no matter what the economy is and no matter where your money is coming from, you're always looking for ways to provide those services in a better way and to provide more services. And like all cities, we've had to, in some ways, cut back on our services and our promises to our residents. I have to say, happily, though, we've also, in that process, found some ways to provide services at a better cost.
I want to talk about the laundry list of cuts that you've experienced, because the personal property tax disappeared. That was the industrial tax. You also have seen property values go down, and the fact that the way our system works, the taxes on those properties won't catch up as fast as the home values do. And most cities, as you mentioned, have underfunded pension plans, higher health care costs for retired workers. It's kind of like a triple gut punch to the budgets. Are your state representatives and state senators aware of these issues?
Lester, I think that they are aware. And to a certain degree, I think that they're holding on to this concept of hope that through the personal property tax reform, you know, that Michigan is going to spark, right? That's the catalyst that's going to spark this significant new investment and redevelopment by industry in our communities that will then create this trickle-down effect to the local level, frankly, where you'll see this influx of new investment that'll lead to an influx of new jobs that'll then lead to an influx of new people moving in or reinvesting in their properties, redeveloping, new developers coming in and whatnot that will ultimately lead to a plus to a community's bottom line.
Have you seen any evidence of that?
Well, and that's where I was about to throw some statistics out. In our neck of the woods, no, not yet at a level in which I can comfortably say that it's actually leading to an uptick in that bottom line. You know, we read headlines almost daily about one big automaker or another investing $1 billion here or $1 billion there. That has not yet necessarily created this sort of statewide influx of dollars. In 2016, as a for instance, 22% of the city's total taxable value, which equated to about 10% of our total general fund revenues, came from personal property tax dollars. In 2017, after now there's been, you know, an implementation in part of the new tax reform, that's now down to 13% of our total taxable value and 6% of our general fund revenues. And so you see it's heading in a sort of downward spiral, which is really scary for a city, especially a small city, where we don't necessarily have a lot of new opportunity for a major plant or a major operator to come in. We certainly have an incredibly robust industrial park with multiple tier suppliers to the auto industry and other industries, which is fantastic for a community of our size. But, you know, I don't have the 200 acres of developable land necessarily where that I can accommodate some major new investors. So while perhaps it's working in some parts of the state, I haven't quite seen it yet work with communities such as Cadillac.
Mayor Mariaski, I'll give you the same question. I want to find out if you're having conversations with your legislators about these problems.
I mean, I think that our local legislators in Southeast Michigan are aware of the situation. I'm not sure that outstate the representatives are as clued into the devastating effects of their financial decisions on the communities. And part of that comes from our term limits, the way term limits have taken away institutional knowledge and how every couple of years we've got to re-educate our legislators.
Well, one would guess that some of these folks have municipal backgrounds, right?
You would think, and you would think that that would carry over. But I think that in many cases, and I would say overall, that this has not played out that way, you know, once folks get to the legislature. Piggybacking off of what the city manager said is that, you know, this expected trickle-down effect that I don't see any evidence for, and over 30 years or so, you know, I've never seen any evidence for, it intersects with the plan that the state also articulates of, you know, building strong communities. And the MML talks about
sense of place.
As part of its
right.
policy, sense yeah. of place, a place that folks want to be a part of, that they have a good quality of life and that they want to invest in financially and, you know, in terms of their families and their lives. If you don't have investment in things like your infrastructure, if you don't have investment in city services that aren't declining but are growing, you are not going to be able to compete with other places that may be more, you know, financially stable in state or out of state. And so there's a snowball effect actually of disinvestment and loss because the cities can no longer provide the kinds of services and levels of services that residents expect and that they should expect. And so the investment goes elsewhere. Then you have a snowball effect of disinvestment.
Mr. Pitch, I want to ask you, are the citizens of Cadillac aware of the financial struggles the cities had to deal with?
We're doing everything we can to make them aware. We have a tremendous amount of information and data that we share through social media, through our website, as a part of our public meetings, and it's part of our dialogue with the community when we have the chance to talk about a lot of the positive things that we're doing, but to sort of couch it as, you know, we're doing these things because of some of these other things. And so while we talk about the decline of revenue sharing and the softness of property values. You know, we also talk about what we are trying to do to improve ourselves. And as the mayor just mentioned, you know, the sense of place and placemaking, you know, Cadillac has essentially tried to grab the reins of a runaway horse from the state and sort of take control of its own destiny. And we have fully, in part, have fully embraced the whole placemaking concept through the leadership from the Michigan Municipal League, Michigan State University, Michigan State Extension, and MISHTA took a major role in the placemaking program that they had, and since then have created a new place for the community to gather at called Cadillac Commons, which is something that is really transformational for our community in our core downtown area. But since moving forward with the placemaking projects that comprise the Cadillac Commons area, we have seen a resurgence of new investment in our downtown area, which is something that I'm not so certain may have come if the community didn't also see the city itself reinvesting in itself.
Mr. Petcha, I got to tell you, if you decide that you're tired of being a city manager, you should definitely work for the Chamber of Commerce there because you're pro-Cadillac. Mayor Majewski, I want to ask you, at one point, Hamtramck was taken over by an emergency manager, and I've been wondering if these cities that have been taken over by an EM would have faced those financial troubles if their revenue sharing had remained at the level it was before.
Revenue sharing is not the only financial problem that cities face. The loss of property values was devastating for many cities, you know, restructuring of personal property tax and other issues. Certainly, revenue sharing alone was not the deciding factor, I would say. But combined with all these other losses, it just becomes a devastating effect. A lot of cities who have not gone into emergency management teeter on the brink. One of the things that sets off emergency management status is that a city has to ask to be examined and to be evaluated by the state. Above my objections, by the way, because I'd been through it before. The city of Hamtramck's been through emergency management and before that through emergency financial management, both while I was in office. Now, I know what that process is like and how devastating it can be for a city. But you know, Hamtramck may be a poster child for that process, but there are many, many cities, because of the preponderance of all of these factors, that are teetering on that brink. And, you know, if community development block grants also go away, our federal government is talking about
reducing those or eliminating
them completely. I mean, many of our cities depend on those funds, CDBG funds, for things like code enforcement, for the things, again, that make life livable, for park improvement, for the things that the city's budget otherwise couldn't accommodate.
I have one more question for both of you. Given the financial struggles of cities around the state, when you hear that the governor wants to have a $500 million rainy day fund, when you hear that the legislature is considering an income tax rollback and you're still not getting the money, you're not made whole, what do you think of those moves in Lansing? Mr. Petcha, we'll start with you.
I think that they really need to be examined in great detail. I don't have a problem with our state government having a rainy day fund. If not for the very conservative budgeting and financial processes that Cadillac has been doing long before I ever arrived and since I've arrived, we would perhaps be in major trouble ourselves. But we're not, and that's because of our very strong conservative fiscal planning. But, you know, to have a rainy day fund at that magnitude – that's being proposed and being talked about in combination with also reducing the income tax levy, I think that that could potentially be a combination or a mixture for ultimate financial disaster and ruin for many more communities across this state. I think that the state needs to figure out a manner in which to carve away a portion of what that potential fund is going to be and rightly so, return it back under state shared revenue formulas to the communities. Ultimately, the services that people across this state get come from the local communities. Businesses are going to locate in communities in which they feel that there's strong support for infrastructure, for recreational opportunities, for the ability for their employees to have a high quality of life. It starts at that grassroots local level. And, you know, if the local level of governance is being strangled, it makes it very difficult, I think, for Michigan to compete, not just in the Midwest, but frankly, on a national scale, if not greater. So I think it's an incredibly important thing for our state to really fully examine and have that conversation with folks at the local level so that they understand the impacts and what their decision making will potentially do.
Mayor Majewski, you get the last word.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with that. Of course, you know, we all need to have some money in the bank, but we also need to invest our resources and invest for development and for further growth. And to have, too large a surplus sitting so that politicians can say, well, look at how much money we have, how much money we've saved.
I think the governor would describe it differently.
I think many of these decisions are political decisions and, you know, decisions based on the next election. And it really does a disservice to the larger impacts that those decisions have on communities that build the state and that create the environment that would attract investment, as the city manager has said, and that would build the state and develop the state in such a way that we really can compete nationally.
Karen Majewski is the mayor of Hamtramck. Marcus Pecha is the city manager of Cadillac. I want to thank you both for coming in and talking to us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, who's been going on and on about today being the 30th anniversary of WrestleMania 3 at the Pontiac Silverdome, biggest indoor crowd ever. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hekala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.